Wisconsin Horticulture Update for Friday, August 30th. This is Kimberly Miller with Winnebago County. I welcome everyone today. We will start this morning with introductions and county roll call. Is there anyone today here from the northern section of the state? I take that as a no. How about the western section? Wow, we're getting a small group today. South?
Lisa from Marquette County.
Marquette. Thank you.
Christy and Rock.
Okay. Anyone else? How about southeast?
Kristen and Waukesha.
Okay, and then I guess East Metro or, you know, the eastern northeast section of the state, besides myself. Okay, and are we missing anyone? Okay, well, I guess it's a holiday weekend. We must have a small group today. We'll move on to any reports. Is anyone would like to give a report?
Okay, Marquette County can start off then. I've had a couple of calls the last couple of weeks on strawberry root weevils. I've had a few people call in. I've had a couple of samples brought in. So that's kind of been in the forefront. And then also a lot of people have been wondering about wild cucumber. Is it an invasive weed or not? And so we've been, you know, clarifying that for them as well. So those are kind of my big couple of topics for this past week or two here.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
This is Kristen. I would echo that. I mean, I personally have plenty of strawberry root weevils crawling around my house. And then the wild cucumber is really kind of going crazy here, too. But we also have, it's been a little while since we got some decent rain, so things are starting to brown out. You know, some low-level kind of nuisance insect issues like bees and things like that. But other than that, it's been pretty quiet.
Okay, thank you.
This Barb in Kenosha. I would say similar to what Kristen said, we are starting to see drought problems. We're also getting quite a few oak samples in with both leaf and stem or twig galls on them. And we're also, once again, starting to get tar spot on maple and mildew on maple culls. Otherwise, it's just an assortment of odds and ends.
And then down in Rock County, it sounds pretty similar to what other people are reporting. More plant and weed IDs this past couple weeks than the rest of the season. Still a handful of mushroom questions. And then we had some oak galls come in last week, and things are kind of drying out. I've noticed a lot of people watering more so than before. And then a lot of inquiry on the county's basis for emerald ash borers and stuff in the local newspapers and stuff. People seem to now be worried about it. So that's what's going on here.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that's joined us late?
Hi, okay. This is Diana up in Pierce County, and what's happening up here sounds like similar to what's happening in the southern part of the state. We're really dry. We've kind of got a little pocket here that's been missed by all the rain that's really hit in the north. And so we have a lot of raspberry issues, it seems, this year. And otherwise, it's been pretty quiet. I think it's been just too hot for people to be outside. So hot and dry.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? Okay, I'll give my report. It's a lot like what everyone else has said. Some areas of our county have received quite a bit of rain in the northern part, but areas in the southern are starting to get fairly dry. We've also had a lot of reports on the cucumber vine. We are starting now to get quite a few calls on Emerald Ash for the paper finally publicized an article on it. And we did have an informational meeting last night for the public that was a joint venture with DNR and with the City of Oshkosh, and we had about 150 people show up for that. And I've already had my phone ringing this morning due to that meeting. But other than that, everything else is kind of a mishmash of calls and is fairly quiet. Are there any other county reports? Okay, with that, we'll move on to the specialist reports. I know Brian's online. Is Phil or any other specialist online?
Phil did sneak out of a faculty meeting, so I'm here too.
Okay. Well, I'll let y'all decide who you want to, who wants to start.
Go ahead, Phil, so you can get back.
Okay. Oh, no, gee, thanks. you know, just kind of the typical stuff, that the wasp complaints continue to ramp up as we often expect at this time of the year. In the scheme of things, this is kind of late, but that's fine. But it will continue for about the next 3 weeks. Lots of crazy spider pictures. This is the time of the year we get orb weavers and fishing spiders and wolf spiders moving around. I've seen a couple cases of fall webworm come in that are well past being active. It's just the people have finally recognized the activity of the tents and the like. And but other than that, said just kind of typical, nothing earth shattering. So, any bug questions?
Okay, if there's no questions for Phil, we'll
I can ask Phil a question. I don't want Phil to feel left out.
No.
So, I have ground bees right in front of my porch. I tried dusting them, and it doesn't seem to be working because I don't think we can quite get to the entrance of the hole because it's underneath a juniper, and I don't really want to stick my hands in there and move the bush around. So, my questions are, A, are ground bees a useful pollinator, and should I just leave them alone for the rest of the year?
Okay.
Or should, or is there a way to control them? Because if they're a pollinator, I can live with it.
So there's only two things that live in the ground in a colony. Those would be bumblebees, and if it's not bumblebees, it's some type of paper wasp, and that's what people often call ground bees.
Okay.
They are more predators than anything else. They will do a little bit of nectaring, but you don't typically think of them as big-time pollinators. The other side of this is that we're about 3 to 4 weeks away, maybe 5 weeks, depending on the fall, of them dying out naturally. So the concern is always people, pet activity, lawn mowing, because that's when the biggest threat is there. But if you don't really know where the entrance is, I don't know any magic. I mean, it really isn't. If we get a really cool morning where you can go out and work where they're not active, but we're probably weeks away from that. And so, you know, when I've had to treat those, I usually just suit up as best I can, quietly go there and maybe just take a small stick to try to lift up the juniper, but you got to get that dust at the entrance or it's just not going to perform.
Is there any way to kind of flood it with some kind of insecticide, like 7 or something, or is that not a good idea?
Well, the liquids tend to get bound up, and that's where the dusts are an advantage. Now, one of the things, excuse me, you might consider is they do have these foaming wasp sprays, and it, you know, it looks like shave cream. It just comes out there in tremendous volume, and that kind of paralyzes them, among other things, and it dissipates pretty quickly. So there are certain times, you know, again, if you're going in there to kind of foam to just slow them down, but I still have far more confidence in dusts than I do any kind of aerosol sprays.
Okay, and then my follow-up question is after they're gone, what can I, should I just try to find the entrance to that hole and fill it in, and that will keep them away from there in the future?
Yeah, they don't reuse the nest, but they're using old gopher burrows or other washed-out areas. So it's all about plugging those habitats. And then, again, you got all the way until next end of May, beginning of June, when the queens are looking for new holes. But the numbers are so small early, nobody has any idea that they're active until we usually get into this time of the year.
Okay. Thank you.
Phil, on a similar question, we've had a couple of calls, including one that's kind of waiting today, on, quote, bees that are in basements. And they say they're, even this one this morning we have that we haven't talked to, is they're fuzzy bees.
Okay, that could be bumblebees. I mean, if they're saying fusty bees, it's got to be bumblebees. So it's kind of similar. They're probably nesting along a foundation. Once in a while, I've seen them in a birdhouse, so they could get in a wall void. The worst thing you can do is to seal the entrance and force them in. So it's really more productive to kind of sit and walk slowly around the outside perimeter of the house and try to pick up where the activity is coming from. And so, you know, you check vents and all those other kinds of things, because that would give you the point that you have to treat, you know, with the dust in the evening. But somehow or another, again, it argues that there's a nest there, and either they're getting confused or the shrubbery has grown enough that the access is somewhat been pinched off. And we want them to come and go, because if they didn't go in the basement, we could probably let them be if it hasn't gotten people's attention by now. Other than this, as I said, in a lot of these nests, they're not worth treating. You just let them die out naturally.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions for Phil? Hearing none, I'll turn it over to Brian for his report.
Okay, lots of vascular wilts again this week. We've just been getting a ton of verticillium coming into the clinic. Hosts for this week, catalpa, Japanese tree lilac, Japanese maple, regular maple, probably in Norway or a sugar, and smoke bush. So there's a lot of verticillium out there. We've also had some oak wilts and Dutch elm disease come in as well. Interesting sample on fruit crops, so brown rot on apple. We normally see this on stone fruits like plums, peaches, that sort of thing, but it does occasionally occur on apples, and it was sporulating quite nicely. And then probably the big news sample of the week was a find of stem and bulb nematode, also called bloat nematode, on garlic. This is one that has gotten a fair amount of press out in the east over the last couple of years, and had a person from Dane County bring in a sample where we confirmed that. So that's pretty much it. Certain other sorts of vegetable leaf diseases, a variety of variations on Cercospora leaf spot on both melon and parsnip, but it's been a pretty interesting week here. Any questions?
This is Ann. I have a question on euonymus, you know, decline basically. So over the course of 2 years, that, you know, thins out, turns red, leaves early, dies out, kind of a thing. They are susceptible to verticillium, right?
Technically, I believe they are, but I've never been able to recover that fungus from that particular shrub, and I've seen a lot of the sort of decline that you're describing. In fact, I had euonymus in my own yard that declined in exactly that way, and it appeared to have a crown infection, and I never did verify what it was, but I could see fruiting bodies in the crown after a while. So I'm not convinced that that decline that you're seeing is actually verticillium. There may be other things going on.
So it could be a crown or a root rot?
Yeah. Mine hung on for about 2 years, and then it got so ugly that I basically cut it out.
Something like if you had five of them planted next to each other, it starts with one, then there's two, that it's going to keep spreading?
It possibly could spread. But again, I oftentimes see these sorts of basically canker diseases on trees and shrubs that are a little bit more, what do I want to say, under stress. So I would evaluate whether the shrub is in generally happy with its environment.
All righty. Well, I might be sending you a sample.
Okay, sounds good. The other thing that I'll mention, mentioning stress, we have been getting a fair number of samples just coming in of this maple issue that Vijay had concerns about, with primarily kind of Norway maples just showing individual branches that are dying back. And the DNR has been shunting me some samples from various parts of the state where people have been seeing this symptom. And we're getting a lot of kind of opportunistic canker organisms out of these dead branches, and so I think in part, again, the trees were probably being stressed by, I suspect, planting issues. I don't think last year's weather helped anything, and that's just predisposing them to these canker organisms that if you had a healthy tree, a vigorously growing tree, probably wouldn't be susceptible to these organisms. I found a fungus called Steganosporium, which has been documented as a stress-related canker organism in maples, and then picked up another one called Massaria, where there are certain species that, particularly in plane trees, can cause some branch dieback, but again, in stressed trees. So I do think a lot of this branch dieback that we're seeing probably has some of its origin in last year's drought, but I would also evaluate trees that are showing these symptoms for other types of stresses, including planting issues.
Any other questions for Brian? Okay, do we have any other specialists on the line today? Okay, since there are none present, I will introduce this week's guest. I'd like to introduce Mark Dwyer. He is with the Janesville Rotary Gardens, and he will be talking today about perennials for foliage. You could have downloaded a copy of his presentation if you wish to view it on your computer, but I will hand it over to you, Mark.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning to everyone. Lovely day down here in Janesville, although we know it's going to get a little bit hotter. 30% chance of rain, although here at the gardens we, of course, never count on that sort of prediction for sure. For those that haven't been to the gardens, we're on our 24th year of history. Next year's our big silver anniversary, and we hope people can come down and enjoy the gardens. We're still looking pretty good, a lot of color. These cooler nights are keeping the colors vivid, and we do hope people will be able to visit. If you've not come to the gardens or you're interested in what's happening, I do want to mention I do an almost daily gardening blog that's on our website. If you were to Google Rotary Gardens, you could get on our website, and there's a link to my blog, which kind of shows what's blooming and what we're doing here at the gardens. Well, jumping to the topic for today, perennials for foliage, hopefully everyone has a copy of that either in paper form or in PowerPoint, and in the next 40 minutes or so, we'll go through a topic that really would take days and days to go through. And keep in mind, I'll be hitting on some of the highlights. And, you know, starting by saying, of course, foliage is an important component for our perennials. And this is a time of year we're walking around our garden seeing all the slug damage and earwig damage and other issues and some of the unsightly things that occur that sometimes are beyond our control or the control of the average homeowner. However, I think the expectation of foliage being clean, looking good, and hopefully also offering beauty is something that's important to stress to the general public and, of course, in our own gardens. Looking at the title slide here, Perennials for Foliage, when I've done talks like this, I always include images that include absolutely no flowers because I think you start to see the subtleties and the nuances that foliage can provide. Here in our shade garden, there's a Japanese painted fern frond laying over a tiarella there, and you can see that subtle foliage. Both of these plants have a different texture, but very similar in terms of coloration with some silvering and some marooning. But those subtleties are what really carry the show. Here's two plants. Of course, ferns don't have traditional flowers. They don't bloom at all, but that tiarella has already bloomed, so we've had that punch of color. But in this case, what we're seeing is the carryover of what foliage can do in our gardens. 20 years ago, when I was designing gardens, I was planning for progression of bloom. It was all about flowers, whether that was perennials, annuals, or woody plants. I've come full circle, and it's really foliage is my primary consideration. And here at the gardens, we have a lot of punch and interest with flowers, without a doubt. And the visiting public wants to see that. But in so many cases with our plant selections, those flowers are very ephemeral or are just a very small portion of the growing season. So we need the foliage to carry over the show. And in many cases, our perennial selections are entirely based on foliage for that impact, whether it's color and or texture. Moving on to the next slide. This is a shot I took a couple years ago. That's and it's not a stage shot. It looks like it, but there's a ginkgo leaf that had fallen on top of red boar kale after a frost. And to me, that's beautiful. And the idea that foliage can be just as important as any flower, I think we all know. I think I'm preaching to the choir. But the gardening public, I think, is still learning how important and vital foliage is texturally and, of course, color, as I've mentioned. The next image. None of these are perennials. What you're seeing here is a shot taken at Olbrich Botanic Gardens a couple years ago. And seeing these bold tropicals in our hot Wisconsin summers. And really the point I want to make here is that foliage can be the primary feature in any arrangement, whether that's a shaded perennial border a small container or this tropical bed near the Thai Pavilion, and you can see the bold texture of cannas. There's castor bean in the center, some blood bananas. And again, we're reliant on foliage in this image. And it works, and there's no doubt that that's important. The next image, just reiterating what I've just mentioned, that value of foliage. The image on the left, that bluish plant is called sea kale, or Crambi maritima. That's native to the United Kingdom. It grows in sandy locations. For us, it's actually a great perennial. And as a side note, the entire plant is edible, leaves, flowers, et cetera. But here in the background, the blue flowers are ajuga, but that plant is planted for the foliage, that nice sky blue look. And again, foliage can be a primary ornamental feature. It can be an additional asset or feature of that same plant, meaning, yes, you maybe purchased it for that flower, but the secondary impact is with that foliage. The foliage should always be a textural contribution. And I'll talk a little bit about texture, not only visual texture. And we all see the gardening magazines that talk about bold and fine being combined, and that works. Textural variation in any composition makes the eye slow down and enjoy the competition, and it's just as important to me as color is. Texture also can apply to tactile as well, and I'll just dabble and touch on that in just a bit. Foliage can be a foil for neighbors. And what I mean by that is something with, let's say, really nice blue foliage, having a plant in near proximity that's yellow, that plant looks better having a nice foil, having that blue backdrop, and vice versa. And I preach color foils not only with perennials but with woody plants and your entire landscape composition. Plants should be good neighbors, not only requiring the same water and sunlight and treatment, but also make each other look better. Of course, foliage can also extend the window of interest. And you'll see some examples of that where the foliage on our perennials can extend interest beyond the flowering period and also, in many cases, well into fall. There's perennials that get a decent fall color. We're just starting to see the start of that here at Rotary Gardens. Next image, the value of texture. And I've said many of these things already. On the right side, you see some hostas. In the foreground of that photo is something called Bloody Dock, which is a perennial with beautiful veined foliage. It's inedible, by the way. Don't ever let it bloom. It'll reseed everywhere. But it here in part shade is a nice textural composition, also combining and adding color. But to the text on the slide, the variation in texture offers visual interest and is essential in creating successful plant combinations. You can combine the best colors, but if texture is missing, more often provided by foliage, you need to incorporate that. Keep in mind that flowers also have a texture and an architecture in and of themselves. Combining different textures is as important as combining colors, and we've already mentioned that. Next image. This is another annual border. This is at Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. When you're on campus, you should visit for sure. Nice 2.5-acre garden. This border, reliant on tropicals, you see silvery cardoon in the back is black magic elephant ear. In your mind's eye, imagine this as a black and white image. And even better, just go to the next slide here, and I've just made it a black and white image. What I'm just trying to do is reiterate the point that even without color, variable foliage texture can offer a lot of interest. And if we only saw in black and white, of course we'd be reliant on different textures, with our perennials, of course, but with all our plants. And that's absolutely vital, and here it certainly works even with a loss of color. Next image, shameless self-promotion for some of the things we do at Rotary Gardens, but I just wanted to show you our entrance garden changes colors every year, and many of you have seen this sort of transition. And yes, we're reliant on a lot of color and some non-living elements here, obelisks, that's PVC pipe painted. The trailing plant coming out of those tubes is Dichondra Silver Falls, which is a seasonal. But notice that rich composition is very reliant on foliage. And in our large annual compositions, we're reliant, we put about a third up to a half that are simply foliage plants to create looks like this. And incorporated throughout that entire border is a lot of foliage interest and color. Next image, a couple years ago, we did a blue and yellow theme. Again, there's a lot of foliage in there, a lot of golden foliage. The vine creeping up those pyramids is lemon lace vine, which is a woody plant. I don't know if it's hardy further north, but for us it comes back every year. but those pyramids went from being just solid blue to being solid yellow by the end of the season. Next image, this is last year. We did a conservative composition with whites and blues, but look at the importance in the center right, that huge patch of dinosaur kale. That offered some puckered texture and interest. In the lower right of the image, there's some faded genes euphorbia. There's all sorts of goodies in there for foliage. And again, we feel that's important. And while I'm talking about annuals and this, these broad expanses, this all applies to perennials and it applies to all our plants. Foliage is very important. And just a brief shot of what's happening this year. We went orange in a big way, but notice the punctuation of dark purple elephant grass throughout this composition and some sedges. We're not sure of the color next year, but rest assured it'll rely on foliage heavily as usual. Let's get back to perennials. Next image, I love using this. This is a composition of perennials in a shaded location. Very little in terms of flower, but what you're seeing is a lot of color. You're seeing a lot of texture. And again, that these assets, the assets of these plants, particularly in shade, the foliage becomes paramount. It becomes vital. And I think everyone would agree that's a beautiful image, not just with the hostas and the pulmonarias. In the lower left is Bowles Golden Sedge, offering a nice punch of color. Upper right is the Haconi grass, Haconochloa. So lots of goodies in there, offering depth, color, texture, and interest, and that's vital. Not that I'm preaching entire foliage compositions, but it's entirely possible to have great interest with that type of approach. Next image, considering foliage. What are some of the features of foliage? Is there a seasonal transition? On the left, I'm not going to remember. I think it's a Heucherella called Pinot Gris. The comment about Heucherellas and Heucheras is they do have seasonal transitions. They look a lot different in summer, for their spring emergence to summer to fall, and you'll see a transition. Many have great fall color, but a lot of the images that are being used to sell these plants are based on a vivid spring coloration. So many of our perennials do have seasonal color transitions, perhaps, again, a fall color. What's the best lighting for optimum coloration? Where do you place these plants to do their best where that foliage pops? And that's a design consideration. It's also a cultural consideration. Where are the plants going to be happy, do well, and perform in terms of that foliage contribution? You do have to consider, are there insect and disease problems? Are your selections prone to certain issues? And again, going through the gardens today, we're just seeing a lot of issues, I think, that are conducive to having such a wet start to the year. But regardless, that fall color, again, is something that most people don't consider with perennials. I take a lot of images in October all the way through November until the snow flies, and we leave a lot of perennials up that have great fall color. Next slide, just an example. I mentioned Heucherellas earlier. It's a cross between a coral bell and a tearella, but here's sweet tea. And sweet tea for us goes through a lot of color transitions, going from this sort of creamy maroon to a deeper maroon. And if you pan to the next image, this is a shot taken in November. And it's a brilliant red. You can see all the leaves falling around it. But it's still offering color when actually most of our deciduous trees have dropped their and shed their leaves. So the perennial garden can include late season color, and there are our perennials that will do that. I think all too often people start cutting back perennials right after the first frost, not knowing that many of these semi-evergreen perennials will offer extended interest well into early December. Next image, another great example, just the common bloody cranesbill geranium. Here's some of the start of its color in September. And that's a plant we've already enjoyed the pinkish flowers in spring. We've sheared it back heavily in early July because it's getting floppy. It's already regrown growth. Now we're seeing it in September and October where it turns red. So we're getting, again, more bang for the buck with these plants with extended seasonal interest. Next image, please. Foliage characteristics. Now, of course, not all flowers are the same, and certainly not all foliage is the same. And we've talked about differences in color. That's the type of thing the consumer can see in magazines, in garden centers. And again, we select plants for color, and that foliage should be a consideration. I like to look at the more subtle nuances of foliage. Now, to the right, that's Euphorbia mercenides, or donkey tail spurge. Side note, it seeds around. It's, I think, banned in some of the western states like Utah because it seeds everywhere. So it can be a bit of a thug, but look at that, those arcing stems with that succulent foliage, powder blue, and that's a light frost on there. So the foliage is offering color, texture. Is the foliage glossy? Is it pubescent or furry? Is there a seasonal shift with color, which we mentioned? So, again, the nuances with foliage should be known with these plants. And while some of them may be subtle, they can carry interest in the garden. And I think it's important to know those things in advance of purchasing and placing these plants. The texture I've talked about already, is there visual weight to the plant, or is there a tactile component, or is it, you know, again, can you touch it? In our garden, we have a lot of kids coming through. Our mission, incidentally, is to provide horticultural education and appreciation for everyone. So it's yellow bus after yellow bus coming to the gardens, and we do always provide a tactile experience. Yeah, next image, please. And I never stop taking pictures of dew beating up on alchemilla or lady's mantle. It's magical. It's the type of thing I think is beautiful and all too often not appreciated. But the slight pubescence of those leaves is what actually captures and forms those beads of water. Next image. Just a brief touch on the tactile nature of plants. This is called woolly sage. Now, Salvia argentea is a zone 5, it's zone 5 hardy, but it's really considered a biennial. Its second year, it'll throw up a white flower. We plant it as a seasonal, but this is like a lamb's ear on steroids. And this is the type of thing that kids of all ages will engage. So again, foliage with our plants might have that additional component. And my younger daughter, who's now 13, the first 6 years of her life, she was picking and denuding our lamb's ear in our front garden at home, because she loved just rubbing it. And we never discouraged her, and that's the type of thing we need to make sure all our kids do. Next image. Safe to assume. These are some considerations as you are selecting perennials. On the left, that's an image of variegated horseradish. Horseradish is can be a bit of a thug in the garden, but I like this one for its patterning. And it certainly can be used in the traditional fashion. Perennial selection should include considering foliage that isn't prone to browning, diseases, insect, etc. So there might be plants that we are wary of simply because of those issues. And for those that are wary of using chemicals and don't want to have a lot of maintenance, you'll start to notice as extension agents, I'm sure, you're seeing all these samples coming in, and you'll see some of these plants that are prone to problems. And I know many are seasonally dependent and regionally related, but again, we try to discourage people from certainly planting those types of plants. Next image, please. What's that window of appeal with foliage? First of all, consider that window of appeal with flowers, which, again, is all too fleeting. You know, a great example on the right, that's in our North Point garden. The perennial there is a penstemon digitalis. That's one called Dark Towers. Beautiful trumpet-shaped dark pink blossoms for about 4 to 5 weeks. This is May into early June. And once the flowers are done, we deadhead this. We cut off the flower stalks, but we get this great, deep burgundy foliage. So what's that window of appeal for the foliage? Foliage that offers color independently of the bloom, for instance, this penstemon, provides the extended interest. So the text you're seeing on the slide really applies to this example and so many of our perennials that also have additional features. And in this case, the tandem appearance of the flowers with the foliage is a great combination. So again, when I talk about foils, combining plants that have neat foliage together, there's also the internal foil of a plant having great foliage that makes the flowers pop and vice versa on the same plant. And there's examples of that. I also feel there's plants that have blooms that don't quite go with the foliage. And that's some perennials, annuals, and woody plants. But that's subjective, and we all have our opinions on that. Next image, please. Another shot taken at Olbrich, and I really was smitten by this combination. There's some boxwoods in there. There's a couple little camassiparis, some golden camassiparis buried in there, but that use of the Hakana Chloe I thought was nice. And in this case, you're seeing a flowing texture, color, in a very simple format. So the ground plane here, to me, was very interesting with the use really of three different plants. But this perennial grass is what really, in my mind, stole the show. Next image. We've seen this already. This is that Cranby again. And I mentioned this is a plant that you would grow primarily for foliage. And whether you're snipping off that foliage for your salads or not is incidental. This will get white flowers, but it's this really vivid, crispy, curled leaf look that provides interest. And we have this prevalent in our Scottish garden, being a native of the United Kingdom. Next image. The sedums are stone crops. Here's Postman's Pride, which is a selection out of Belgium, and there's been a lot of developments in these dark leaf sedums over the years. This will eventually get some medium pink flowers that's starting to flower now, but that foliage from the minute it emerged from the ground in early May until it's cut back after frost is a contributor in the garden. And to me, the flowers are incidental. Yes, I like the late season flowers, but this right now is currently the darkest sedum in my mind, and we punctuate a lot of the dark stone crops throughout the garden, combining them with whites and yellows and other plants where that deep color creates depth in a border and, of course, visual interest. Be wary with sedums. I'm sure you get a lot of calls about, no, my sedum's floppy. It's, you know, it's not doing well. They don't like ultra-rich soils. They really prefer lean soils. And we're not shy about cutting sedum back severely, usually in mid to late May when they're about 8 to 12 inches. We'll shear them back, and it looks like a weed whipper hit them. But they bounce back, and they tend to be a little more compact, less prone to splaying out. So, again, lean soils is really the key. Love that variety, though, Postman's Pride. Next variety, Heliopsis, Lorraine Sunshine. I call this a reverse variegation. I don't think that's the correct term, but you'll note that the venation is still green, but everything in between is this cream color. You know, Heliopsis as a native, wonderful daisy flowers, but in this case, this foliage is a contributor in the garden. Be wary of foliage, whether it's with any type of plant. Sometimes foliage can look sickly. I feel some golden selections of various plants look nitrogen deficient. Sometimes some of these fancy plants just don't look quite right. But I think this variety has a lot of interest before it blooms. If you go to the next image, you'll see it in bloom. And the bloom time is 5 to 6 weeks of putting up these daisies. Lorraine Sunshine, I'm not entirely sure about its reseeding. We've seen green seedlings come up, and we've occasionally seen a variegation come up. It tends to be shorter than the straight species, but wonderful in the in the full sun garden. So I like to pick some of these more interesting foliage types because they really pop. And similar to what I said about the previous sedum, this foliage looks dynamite from May all the way till, for us, mid-October when it gets frosted down. Next image, irises. You know, I always feel there's nothing better than an iris in bloom, and usually there's nothing worse than an iris out of bloom. You know, our Siberians are floppy and ratty right now. The German irises, bearded irises, don't look real good. We have a lot of iris borer here that we're dealing with, but there are iris selections that, beyond their flowers, offer interesting selections. And I'll back up by saying there's many standard perennial species that do have other opportunities, other selections of variegation or different foliage that may be selected again for added oomph out in the garden. So the sweet irises, like Iris pallida, this is elbow variegata, which has a nice white variegation. To me, that looks great before it blooms, when it blooms, and after it blooms. If you go to the next slide, you'll see Aurea variegata, the golden variegated form. And those sword-like leaves coming out of the soil, I think, offer a lot of interest and drama. And I prefer these to most of the irises we're currently growing. If you go to the next image, you know you're stuck with that, but that's not too bad. Both have a very similar blossom, and I think that has some interest. And don't get me wrong, I love irises, but wouldn't it be great if all our irises had some sort of subtle variegation to make that foliage not just disappear and then become a liability later in the season? Next image. Going back to selecting perennials for added foliage interest, Tradescantias or spiderworts. I have to tell you, most of the spiderworts out in the gardens we're removing because of reseeding issues. We've seen a little reseeding with this one, and oddly enough, the seedlings are green. If you ever have this, incidentally, a golden leaf sweet cate, sometimes called blue and gold, if you ever see green coming in up in the middle of it, it's reseeded in the midst of itself, so you have to get in there and separate those out. But what a great plant for a nice bright color in sun or part sun. If you go to the next image, there are those characteristic spiderwort blooms, which are great in spring. But it's that golden foliage that carries over a grass-like texture that has a lot of illumination. And I always talk in part shade, or as you get in the shade, the illumination of adding yellow and white really offers the color, because you do become more reliant on foliage interest, not only color, but texture in the shade. Next image, phlox, garden phlox. mildew issues this year. We have quite a bit of mildew all through the gardens. This one doesn't seem to have any, but the comment here is, here it is before it's blooming. And I love variegated garden flocks. You know, we're expecting the fragrant flowers shortly. They're actually blooming right now. But here's a nice, crisp variegation on a new selection. And there's some older varieties as well. They tend to be less vigorous than the green leaf varieties. But instead of having, and forgive me for this, but garden flocks, instead of having a big blob of green that you're waiting for your summer flowers to come and then fade, then to have another blob of green that becomes whitish with mildew, why not have something that's offering this foliage punch throughout the year? And you'd have to be careful how you use it. If you go to the next image, here it is. There you see some lavender in there. To the right is Russian sage, delphinium in the distance, pink rose in the back. But here it's a focal point. So this phlox hasn't even bloomed yet, and it's creating interest. Imagine this were a green variety. The flowers would be beautiful, no doubt, but this thing has contributed since its emergence. The flowers on Shockwave, incidentally, are vivid pink. Next image, Amsonia hubrictii, or willow leaf Amsonia, another North American native. Here it is blooming. It's also called a blue star flower. The flowers are very light blue, and they're quite quick. You get about 2 weeks of this. You can see the texture. So the visual texture is there. This was a perennial plant of the year a couple years ago. But what I love about Amsonia is not only the blooms, but we're getting interest from this plant from May all the way through October. And if you go to the next image, here it is out of bloom. In midsummer, you start to see it turn a little chartreusey. Now, to me, that's quite textural, and we use it in many areas in the garden, 3 to 4 feet usually. What I'm really waiting for is the next image. And what you're seeing there is the fall color of that same species. And it's variable. Some years it's a pure yellow. Some years you get more rust or orangey color to it. But this thing has offered flowers, texture, fine texture, of course, and this at the end of the season. So to me, that's a plant with seasonal interest. And again, back to some of my earlier comments, yes, we all select plants for one. Sometimes we select a plant for that blip of interest, and in many times that's valid. And that's subjective. You know, you or the homeowner, you pick something, and you know it's going to be brief, but you want to enjoy it. With limited budgets and limited space, I think people are looking for more of plants like this where they can get extended interest. If you go to the next image, talking about foliage, and I did a talk a couple weeks ago, I believe, on perennials in the garden, and talked about some of these same plants. But in the shade, again, reliance on texture and color. Here's a great example. I have some hostas in the background. That blue is beautiful. But to the right, there's the mocha coral bells, and to the left, there's all gold Hakana Chloa. So a composition, and all of these plants flower, but the flowers are not why they're purchased. It's the foliage, and in this case, to me, offering a lot of interest, and what I said earlier about illumination holds true with that grass in the foreground. The next image, a little comment about coral bells. You know, there's a couple years ago we looked at having a collection here, and this is 5 or 6 years ago. We researched how many varieties were out there. There were literally over 300 varieties. There's now currently over 500 varieties, and there's no stop to it. And I have mixed feelings on coral bells. I think it's important to mention, as a foliage perennial, they're dynamite. What I said earlier holds true. Keep in mind that keeping these plants happy will affect not only the vividness of their color, but also the progression of their coloration. There's no coral bell out there that looks the same when it emerges from spring and when we head into frost. They all have some sort of a transition. Some of these golden types that you see in this image can get a little crispy as they get into more sun. They really need moist, well-drained soil. And we've lost more heucheras than we've established here. And we love dabbling with them, but keep them happy. They are not a shade perennial. Don't put them in shade. They really need some degree of sunlight. That happiness is important. Next image, caramel. You saw it earlier, mocha. Caramel is another variety, a selected variety of the Velosa-type heucheras, which tend to be bigger. Tend to maintain their color better and can take a lot more sun. Caramel is awesome, and there's been many orange ones over the last 10 years. Caramel, to me, is still one of the best in terms of that orangey coloration. When it emerges from the soil, it tends to have a reddish cast. If you look closely into that plant, the newest leaves are the maroonish ones. The oldest ones are those that have faded to a kind of a cream. But that bitoned effect, I think, is vital. So back to Heuchera villosa. The villosa types, I think, are dynamite in the garden. And again, not only for stature, but color. Next image, there's Mocha again. I won't belabor the point on this. But if you can see, the underside of some of those leaves actually has a deeper maroon. And these plants are rarely bothered with any insect or diseases, and I think are vital. Next image, one of the fancy new varieties, Cherry Coke. And we have this in the gardens. It's done well. Again, we keep it happy with nice, rich soil, plenty of irrigation, and ample sunlight. So I am excited about developments in Heucheras, and advances in tissue culturing have made these readily available. I think they're introduced very quickly, and I feel the public is still kind of, the jury's still out on how they feel about them. There's a lot sold. We get a lot of comments in the garden about Heucheras dying. Winter mulching is also not a bad idea, so that woody-type crown doesn't heave out in March the following year. So we do apply about a 1-inch mulch around these every fall, if possible. But Cherry Coke, you can see how it gets its namesake.
Mark, not to interrupt, but
sure.
You got 5 minutes.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I better fly then. All right, let me go at a good pace here. Fallopias, variegated. This is in the knotweed family, so be wary. This isn't one that spreads like what's called Japanese bamboo or some of the persicarias or polygonums. This one has a great creamy variegation. Pink flowers late in the season, but great cream variegation. Brunneras, false forget-me-nots. Nice flowers in early spring, heart-shaped leaves. Very few foliage problems, but love Jack Frost for that silver patina. Next image, looking glass if you like to go all silver. Lots of Brunneras out there. Pick them for foliage. Don't ever grow the green variety. There's no reason. But you can get them in gold. You can get them gold-margined, spotted. There's, again, many, many varieties. And they're great in the part shade garden and deer-resistant. Next image, pulmonarias, the lungworts, also disease-resistant. Here's Diana Claire. Great silver foliage. The impatiens are doing the business with flowers, but Diana Claire here is offering that silvering. Pulmonarias also have great spring blooms, usually in the blue-pink range, sometimes raspberry or white. We like to plant them in groupings to create a pseudo-ground cover, and they are a clumping perennial. Next image, raspberry splash, just another variety. Spotted gets its namesake for those raspberry-type flowers, which usually come in late April, early May. The next image, epimediums. I can't say enough about the barren warts. Beautiful foliage. Many times there's a patina in spring. Here, epimedium rubrum. Next image, flowers are beautiful, but this is a ground-level shot. Very orchid-like in appearance. The blooms last about 3 weeks, but in this case, the foliage is dynamite. And this is what the foliage turns in October into November. Many epimediums have great fall color. Leave them. Don't cut them until spring. Leave them up. Aruncus, goat's beard. Here's fern leaf goat's beard. Beautiful flowers, but the ferny foliage carries over. Bleeding hearts, next image. Get the gold. You get gold heart has not only great flowers, but is a great punch of color with that gold foliage. Ligularias, Przewalskii. Ligularias are known for nice flowers, usually in midsummer. Here's one that has some very textural interest in shade, into part shade. Needs lots of water, though, and if you've grown ligularia, keep it happy with those moist soils. Next image, Coringa shoma, very maple-like, large tropical leaves. Hardy to zone 5 have to be protected further north, but right now it's starting to get yellow blossoms, which you see in the next image. Also called yellow waxy bells. Next image, Rogersias, great for part shade, get large astilbe-like flowers, and beautiful leathery leaves. Kim, if you need to cut me off, let me know. I'm going to keep rolling here, though.
Okay, with a small group, we can do a few minutes here.
Okay, thank you. Chocolate Wings Rogersii in the next image. Many Rogersias are selected for very deep maroonish spring coloration, which usually fades by midsummer. Once we get some heat, they turn to green. Rarely see any foliage problems with Rogersias. Hostas, I won't spend much time on this. They're great. You know, we have a lot of slug issues here. We have over 600 varieties at the gardens, and they aren't utilitarian in some ways, but beautiful in many others. Next image, just a sampling, Remember Me. Many hostas also will have a transition of foliage. Do consider hostas with fragrant flowers as well. Next image, Electrocution. So there's a lot of neat ones with rippled edges. Some have colorful stems or petioles. Select them. It's a subjective thing. And, you know, the hosta nuts out there, it's just amazing, the variability out there. Next image, Blaeniastrum, Herman's Pride. Select it for its yellow spring flowers, but look at this silver patterning on the leaves. Never grow the creeping Blaeniastrum called Variegatum. It's a thug. You'll never get rid of it. But if you go to the next image, Herman's Pride stays in a nice beach ball-sized shape. This plant we have in sun, part sun, and deep shade, and it offers that silvery echo throughout the season. Next image, we've talked a little bit about ferns. Many great selections of Japanese painted ferns like Silver Falls. Grasses, I know you've already had that topic, but for foliage, as a foliage perennial, grasses offer great texture and color. Variegatus, here's a grass that's going to be in need of division. It's important to let people know that some of these larger grasses, it's a real feat to get these divided. But it is essential as they vacate the oldest portion of the plant in the center and become that donut, as we call it, when they emerge in spring. Next image, here's a dwarf porcupine grass called Goldbar, and I'll let you can see the foliage contribution and the texture as we go through these. Next image, Dewy Blue. This is a great grass for that bluish cast. And again, grasses should be considered for proper sighting, ultimate size, and their form. Many are upright, some are vase-shaped or arcing. Make sure you know your grass. Many of the switchgrasses, next image, like Shenandoah, gets a great fall color. And some of this ruby tinting happens in midsummer, but they get darker and darker. The next image, Cheyenne Sky. I took this a couple days ago, and to me that's just beautiful as it starts. And it'll get almost entirely red by October. And next image, that Hakana Chloe, as you can grow it, great forest grass for your part shade and shady areas. Next image, Bowles Golden Sedge. Talked about that. Next image, just want to cap by saying foliage is so important in our compositions, whether it's an annual composition like this at Chanticleer in Pennsylvania. Those columns of yellow, that's a golden jasmine up a structure. That's called Fiona Sunrise. But notice the great texture with all the tropicals. And, of course, our vignettes in the next image can include not just perennials but all sorts of plants. And the last image, I just want to say thanks. And sorry I had to speed up there, but, Kim, I'll leave it to you if we have time for questions or not. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that wonderful presentation, Mark. And if anyone has any questions, we probably have time to take just a few. No questions? Well, thank you, Mark, very much. Love the presentation. Beautiful pictures.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So thank you. And so at this time, we'll take announcements from any of the agents or educators online. No announcements? Okay, at this time, I guess we'll wrap up. I want to wish everyone a happy Labor Day. Enjoy your weekend, and we will be back here next week, Friday, September 6th. Jane Anklin with Douglas County will be hosting. The guest for next week will be Joe Van Rossum, composting. So thank you very much.